They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Burgers? Check. Dogs? Check. Beer, lemonade, and sparklers? Check. Now, if only we could celebrate the country's independence with a few million more jobs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, the social network where people can make new friends who share their interests. People talking about today's news at news.gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Friday. It is the second day of July. Wasn't good, could have been worse. That was the verdict of one of those economic prognosticating outfits as we head into this holiday weekend with the latest job figures. The unemployment rate actually fell 2 ticks to 9.5%, but that's mostly because a lot of people got discouraged and gave up looking for a job, which means they are not even counted anymore. Payrolls dropped by 125,000 jobs, but most of that was because temporary census workers are done. So what's the big picture here? We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to suss it out for us.
Gary Burtless at the Brookings Institution has seen plenty of recession recovery cycles since he became an economist in the late 1970s. He says the employment hole we've got to dig out from this time is the deepest yet.
Somewhere between 8 and 9 million.
Just how hard will it be to get back to break even? Burtless says consider two of the biggest employment sectors, construction and manufacturing. Construction lost a quarter of its workforce, and a year into the recovery, it's still shrinking because of the glut from the housing boom. Manufacturing employment shrunk by more than 15% in the recession.
We know from the post-war record that manufacturing doesn't necessarily come back.
Factories have started hiring again, but Burtless thinks some of the lost jobs will never return. You can blame cheap foreign competition and productivity gains for that. The bright spots in the recession have been healthcare, education, and government, but even some of that is faltering.
State and local governments faced very dire budget situation, and I'm afraid a lot are probably going to shrink their payrolls.
The federal government, of course, already has, with the end of temporary census work, which kicks 500,000 or so mostly white-collar workers onto the unemployment rolls.
For me, it's back to the full-time job hunt.
51-year-old Larry Lomax looked for almost a year before finally landing a job with the census in January. He stayed 6 months and finished up today, using his previous experience as an insurance executive and IT manager to move up the ranks. He says there was solidarity at the census.
Some of my colleagues along the way, we all cheered for each other as people found jobs and went on to full-time regular employment.
Though they were few and far between, Lomax kept sending out resumes the whole time and didn't get a bite in what is still a fiercely competitive job market. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
So the overall unemployment numbers aren't pretty, but the complete picture is in some ways incomplete. When you break down these numbers by race, an even worse situation emerges for African Americans. UC Berkeley's Center for Labor Research released its first Black Employment and Unemployment Index today. Stephen Pitts is a labor policy specialist there and joins us for a look at the results. Welcome to the program.
How are you doing?
Very well, thank you. What was the unemployment situation for Black Americans before the recession, and how has that changed, including the latest figures out today?
The last month's reports were 15.4% for African Americans, and that's virtually unchanged from the rate of 15.5% in May. If you compare it to what was happening at the beginning of the recession in December of 2007, the rates were 9.0. So we see an increase by a good 6 percentage points.
And again, just to point out the obvious, that is much, much higher than the overall unemployment rate.
Yes, it is. You see roughly consistently for the last 4 decades, a ratio roughly 2 to 1 between black and white unemployment rates.
And within the African community, obviously, there are still more categories, male, female, young workers, older workers. How do those compare to one another?
Well, if you look at black women, the rates for black women last month were 11.8%. That fell slightly from a rate of 12.4% in May. For men, this past month, it was 17.4%. That slight increase from 17.1%. For teens, the numbers were extremely high, kind of horrific. Overall, it's a slight increase from 38% in May to 39.9% in June. What you saw, though, for black male teens, it rose to 43.2%.
43%?
It's huge. One thing to keep in mind, from month to month, you see very volatile numbers, but still these are very, 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 very high numbers and portend a serious problem down the road.
And presumably it's going to take longer to get out of that situation even than the general population then.
Well, take longer, but also take some direct action as well. There's a tendency to simply want to kind of wave our hands and hope things get better. And as I said, we've seen for the last 50 years roughly a consistent ratio of black to white unemployment of 2 to 1.
Then what would your recommendations be for specific programs targeted to this community?
First thing, I'd stabilize the economy, which means a second and larger stimulus package. It's also important to make sure that those attempts to create jobs focus on distressed communities in particular. In addition, you need to make sure that we have explicit attempts to fight racial discrimination. We found that consistently when blacks go into the labor market, we find them disadvantaged as well.
Stephen Pitts is a labor policy specialist at the University of California at Berkeley. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Now, I'm not generally one to steal other people's material, but this one from the folks over at The Motley Fool is so good, it bears repeating. It's the opening line of their story about the new iPhone and its signal issues. What do Apple and a drunk pulled over by the cops have in common? They're both lying about bars. Turns out the real problem with the new phone is that its software tells you you have a strong signal, 4 bars, when actually it's a weaker and more typical 1 or 2. Marketplace's Bob Moon has the latest.
The sleek and user-friendly design of the iPhone has gotten rave reviews from the start, never mind regular complaints about dropped calls. The blame for that has fallen mostly on the gadget's overloaded service provider, AT&T. Last month, when an embarrassed Steve Jobs couldn't get the new iPhone 4 to connect to the Internet during his debut demonstration, one audience member shouted snidely that Jobs should try using AT&T's biggest rival.
Well, geez, I don't like this. Scott, you got any suggestions?
It turns out Verizon might not have helped either. Apple now admits its exalted iPhone has been overstating its own strength, signal strength, that is. But as NPD Group analyst Ross Rubin points out, that doesn't necessarily take the heat off AT&T.
That's the bad news, that, you know, the signal strength has been even worse than you thought it has been.
Apple says it will send out a software fix soon to give customers a more accurate or less misleading display of signal bars. But some customers complained immediately that won't do anything to fix the real problem, serious signal dropouts that plague the new iPhone 4. Wired Magazine's Elliot Van Buskirk says the design puts users in contact with the phone's wraparound antenna.
They've been doing tests on the actual signal strength, not the perceived one that Apple's talking about, but the actual signal strength appears to be degraded significantly when you hold the phone in a completely normal way.
A few customers are already suing the company for failing to fix a faulty design. Van Buskirk finds that ironic for a company like Apple.
You know, really, they are perfectionists, and that's not just marketing, that's the truth. You know, I've been covering this company for years, and they obsess over the most minor details.
Apple says unhappy users are free to return the iPhone for a refund within 30 days. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, investors will be more than a tad relieved to get away from it all for the long weekend. Stocks closed out their worst week in 2 months today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. We learned earlier this week that applications for new mortgages are down 36% from this time last year. That's despite the fact that interest rates on those mortgages are at their lowest level in 50 years. That is not good news for builders like Horton, KB Homes, and Pulte, three of the biggest names in home construction. But one home builder is still going strong, Habitat for Humanity. In fact, the Georgia-based nonprofit recently found itself on a list of the top 10 builders in the country. That is a first for Habitat. Eve Tro reports on how the nonprofit is rebuilding itself for an even bigger role in the housing sector's recovery.
When a construction company decides whether to build a house, it looks at who might buy it. Harvard housing expert Nick Retsina says Habitat for Humanity looks at who doesn't have one.
They look at their capacity through the use of volunteers, but their more crucial variable is need. And sadly, in this day, the need for affordable housing is more severe than ever.
Retsina says private builders aren't interested in building affordable housing because many customers can't get a mortgage right now, even for the cheapest homes. Habitat for Humanity has always sold homes to working low-income families. They work side by side with volunteers to build their house from scratch. But Habitat Senior Director Mark Andrews says that may change.
In many communities, new housing doesn't make an awful lot of sense.
He says Habitat can't ignore all the empty, bank-owned properties that families could move into instead. The organization plans to maintain its building rate of about 5,000 homes a year, but it's also started to buy, repair, and sell foreclosures. Andrew says it's a big departure from the group's core focus on home building as barn raising.
While new house construction may be a bit more glitzy when you stand up the walls and kind of have that photographic moment, really the impact of restoring foreclosed properties, homes that frankly are a blight to the community, is even more powerful in many ways.
But it's also more challenging. Rehab work is complicated for volunteer crews. It's often more expensive than new construction. And Habitat has to compete with companies who are scooping up blocks of foreclosures to eventually sell in a stronger market. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
The markets certainly had their ups and considerable downs this week, but the economic numbers that trickled in over the past few days are all about the long term, and none of it was good, from home sales to unemployment, all of which calls into question whether we are in or out of recovery. For our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we're joined by Felix Salmon of Reuters and Megan McArdle of The Atlantic Magazine. Welcome to you both. I hope you have stocked up on charcoal.
Actually, we're a gas grilling family, but yes.
Felix?
It's going to be a fabulous weekend.
Yes, although we are not going into it on a terribly positive note, given what has gone on with the unemployment figures. You know, we talked about this at the top of the show, but I wanted to get both your takes on these numbers. What do they mean for recovery, Megan?
We were on a trend of shrinking job shrinkage, if that makes sense, that we were losing fewer and fewer jobs, but that was temporarily disrupted by the massive hiring for the census. And once that's abated, as it now is, then the numbers started going back to the trend, which is still positive compared to, say, a year and a half ago, but negative compared to what you'd like to be seeing, which is some jobs being created to sop up the large excess labor force that we now have.
Yeah, I, for one, am glad that at least next month we won't have all these caveats because of those census workers. Felix, should we really be so obsessed with the monthly movements here?
No, but if you look at the big percentage figures as opposed to the little monthly fluctuations, you can see some pretty depressing trends. One of the things which really jumped out at me this month was what's known as the labor participation rate, the percentage of the labor force who's actually working. It's never been lower. And so when Megan says that we're better off than we were a year ago, I don't see that. I see less chance of people being able to get work if they've been unemployed for a long time. And I see a lot of the preconditions for a very demoralized labor force in this country.
Of course, all this came about in large part because of the economic crisis. And out of that, we finally do have potentially some financial regulation, but hit a snag this week after longtime Democratic Senator Robert Byrd passed away. Felix, what happens to that bill now?
Well, it's certainly not going to get signed before the 4th of July, which is what everyone thought it would be. It's back in this weird congressional limbo. I'm sure that we'll wind up with something. But we're back to the horse trading and the counting votes in the Senate and can you pass a filibuster? You wind up with a weirdly jerry-rigged bill at the end of it, which is designed entirely politically and it doesn't really make a lot of coherent sense. It's still a lot better than nothing, but it's less good than we could have hoped for.
Megan, any surprise that a bank tax became the sticking point here?
What it's boiled down to is that the Democrats are against the banks and the Republicans are against the Democrats. And so anything that the Democrats want to do, the Republicans almost reflexively oppose. And, you know, with that dynamic, that means that everything is back on the table.
You know, one thing that strikes a lot of folks about the bill, I think, is that there are a lot of provisions that turn out to be exceedingly vague, left to regulators to get specific. How effective can that really be, Megan?
On the one hand, people worry that in the last decade or two, regulators got lax. They got more and more cozy with the people that they were regulating. And so there's a desire to write really firm, hard and fast rules so that the regulators can't get beyond them. The problem with that is that rules, when they are hard and fast, are easier to game, right? Once you know what the target that you're shooting for is, it's a lot easier to hit it.
But I think that Megan is right. We live in a world where regulators tend to be paid much less and get much less respect than the people they're regulating. What happens is the sophisticated and highly paid banks wind up running circles around their regulators and persuading them that everything they're doing makes perfect sense, and the regulators wind up preventing absolutely nothing. So in my ideal world, what we'd have would be smart and well-paid regulators, but also be another layer of rules layered on top of that, which would prevent the banks from doing the most egregious kind of things, which they might be able to persuade the regulators was a good idea.
I agree with Felix about the problems of regulatory capture, but you also have to remember that the rulemakers themselves are often prone to be captured by these interests. And so whether you can actually get these sort of ideal rules is, I think, still open to question.
All right. Megan McArdle, business and economics editor at The Atlantic, and Felix Salmon, blogger at Reuters.com. Thanks to both of you, and be careful with those fireworks, okay?
Thanks, Seth. You too.
Will do.
Coming up, workplace wisdom in a summer book review.
Scrap meetings. 10 people in a one-hour meeting is actually 10 wasted hours, not one. Spread your workforce across continents. Quality work performed in another country is still quality work and likely cheaper.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, the Dow shaved off another 46 points today, nearly 0.5% to close at 9,686. The Nasdaq bumped down 9 points. That's almost 0.5% to end the day at 2091. The S&P 500 dropped 4 points, finishing at 1022. For the week, the Dow dropped 4.5%. The Nasdaq unplugged nearly 6%. And the S&P 500 slid 5%. Blockbuster sank more than 20% today to under 18 cents a share. The video rental company got word that it will be delisted from the New York Stock Exchange because of its less-than-boffo share price. It was also a turbulent day for the airlines. United flew down more than 10%. Continental lost 9%. Delta was off course by nearly 6%. Southwest and the parent company for American Airlines both descended more than 2%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.98%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. Toyota Motor Company begins a worldwide recall of more than 200,000 cars. The company will repair an engine problem in Lexuses and other models. Wisconsin becomes the 28th state to ban smoking in public places. And if hot weather's making you sweat, just take it all off. It's the start to Nude Recreation Week. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Business management is both an art and a science. Some follow the rule book to the letter. Others just toss it out the window. Today, contributor Kevin Pereira wraps up our summer book series with his nomination, a guide on how to run your company that firmly belongs in the latter camp.
When it comes to business management, everything you know is wrong. But you knew that already, right? Well, thankfully, there's a book that can help. It's Rework from 37 Signals, a software company that churns out wildly successful web applications. Its project management system is used by Adidas, National Geographic, and Warner Brothers, just to name a few. Rework is a refreshingly honest guide to everything, from hiring practices to creating corporate culture. Think of it as a chicken soup for the entrepreneurial soul. The Rework Gospel includes the following advice. Scrap meetings. 10 people in a one-hour meeting is actually 10 wasted hours, not one. Spread your workforce across continents. Quality work performed in another country is still quality work and likely cheaper. Failure is not a prerequisite for success. The only thing you learn from a mistake is that you made one. So focus on what works and you'll know what to do next. Apologize earnestly and openly. If you screw up, own up, and the forgiveness and respect will follow. Oh, and everyone leaves at 5. Really, the guys who are burning the midnight oil are only clouding up the office with thick plumes of mismanaged time. Now, these aren't the cocktail napkin scrawlings of some jaded cubicle dweller. These are the genuine best practices of a transparent company turning serious profit. This streamlined read challenges the myth that because something has been done a certain way for ages, that it must be the right or only way to do it. So whether you're perched comfortably atop the corporate ladder or squirming in the soil at the bottom of the totem pole, Rework will simultaneously inspire and entertain you.
Kevin Pereira co-hosts G4's Attack of the Show. We're continuing the series all summer long on our website. Visit marketplace.org to read all the recommendations and reviews and post your own. This week's auto sales figures provide some solace for car makers. The industry sold 14% more cars last month than it did in June of 2009. The recovery is due in part to global demand. In fact, General Motors announced it's now selling more vehicles in China than in this country. But one place you won't find many cars is in the Amazon. Annie Murphy reports on one Peruvian city of 400,000 people that relies almost entirely on motorcycles and how one automaker decided to capitalize on that.
Dense, swampy rainforest and wide rivers surround the city of Iquitos, Peru. There are no roads in or out, so the city depends on river ports like this one, which makes it hard to get things here, including cars. Instead, most people use motorcycles and motorcycle taxis, which are like rickshaws mounted onto motorcycle bodies. The streets are full of them, and it's commonplace to see people carrying groceries, building supplies, and even animals on the back of a motorcycle. Tito Torrejon oversees Honda's motorcycle line in Peru.
In one house, you'll find 3 or 4 motorcycles. Mom, dad, brother, and sister all have a motorcycle. The motorcycle culture here is outstanding.
And a few years ago, Honda came up with a simple idea. They built a motorcycle factory right in Iquitos and called it Honda Jungle.
Today in Iquitos, we have more than half the market share. About 20-30% of the motorcycles we make there stay in Iquitos, and the rest get shipped out by riverboats to other parts of the jungle.
But not everyone is pleased about the surge in motorcycles. Hermógenes Curichivo has driven a moto taxi since he got laid off his job at a lumberyard last year. He says that driving a taxi puts food on the table, but that these days there are so many motorcycle taxis on the streets, it's hard to get passengers. In the 1980s, there were just several hundred of these moto taxis. Today, Iquitos is home to tens of thousands of motorcycles. That's thanks in part to Honda Jungle.
It's been successful. Last year we produced 12,000 motorcycles in Iquitos, and this year we've set a goal of 25,000.
Doubling production in 1 year shows just how successful Honda Jungle is. And it also helps that Peru's economy is among the fastest growing in the region. Of course, there is a downside to having the streets overflowing with motorcycles and motorcycle taxis. The noise. Walter Saxer is the Swiss-born owner of a small hotel in Iquitos and has lived here for several decades. He's not pleased about the growing motorcycle business.
With all the street noise, you become aggressive. Just try to talk to somebody, you go crazy.
But the upside is it's easy to get where you need to go and a lot more fun than riding in a car. In Iquitos, Peru, I'm Annie Murphy for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And as we wrap things up on this Friday before Independence Weekend, let's take a moment to review not the major news of the week, but the items that didn't quite make the headlines. Courtesy of Brendan Noonan, Rico Galliano, and select members of the Marketplace staff.
Delassi Michalis, web developer, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, apparently this company came up with a sort of lightsaber that emits a very, very, very powerful laser. And
Wait, a real lightsaber?
Well, it's real enough that George Lucas ordered a cease and desist on it because it resembles a lightsaber. The company says, quote, it is the most dangerous laser ever created.
And the purpose of this is what, to have our nation's geeks accidentally decapitate themselves? We're in an economic downturn. We need geeks.
Well, I was thinking about using it as a laser pointer to scorch my enemies' PowerPoint presentations.
Bill Radke, host of the Marketplace Morning Report. What's your story this weekend?
As I'm pouring the dinner drinks, I'm going to talk about wine vending machines.
Is this a fantasy of yours?
No, this is a reality of mine. They have vending machines where you can buy wine by the glass or the taste if you pass the machine's breathalyzer. Some of the glasses go for $50 a piece.
So imagine shoving 50 perfect ones into a vending machine.
And if you fail the breathalyzer, then the machine will refund your money 200 quarters.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Worst hangover ever, Rico. This trader, Stephen Noel Perkins, just got fined $100,000. He got drunk and he bought $500 million worth of oil futures.
Did that pay off for him?
Actually, his company lost $10 million, and he actually pushed the price of oil up to a record high last year.
I think we owe this guy a great debt. It's like no matter what mistakes we make while drunk, at least we didn't buy $500 million in oil futures.
I know. I feel so much better about a couple of like really unfortunate karaoke incidents.
And you can catch more of Brendan and Rico on their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download. And we've got a link at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 46 points, nearly 0.5%. The Nasdaq lost 9 points, 0.5% as well. And the S&P 500 closed flat. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, we'll show you the winning secret behind any successful 4th of July celebration.
We're going to start with the most important part, which is beer.
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 And the end.
Yeah, bring exactly. It. Barbecue over. You won.
Beer. I'm Tess Vigeland. Have a great weekend and happy 4th.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.